and free weights. Sometimes I would try to call other people in the company to get important information for our project. The response was always the same. Who are you and what do you want to know? I would try to sound important by invoking the first name of the senior vice president and describing how the fate of the free world depended on this vital transfer of information. For example, Bill needs it to keep our great nation independent. But somehow, they always figured out I was a 22-year-old guy with a bad haircut and a cheap suit sitting in the storage room just off the parking lot. If I was especially charismatic that day, they would have the courtesy to swear at me before hanging up. Eventually, Dean and I degenerated into a pattern of sitting in our little bare room, gossiping about coworkers, balancing our checkbooks, and fantasizing about whether the sun was out that day. When we got bored, we would hypothesize about the information we needed, talking about it for hours until we were both pretty sure what it should be. Then we packaged it up as user requirements and gave it to a woman named Barbara, who programmed the system in about 2 weeks. The whole project took about a year, because it's not the type of thing you want to rush. When it was done, the results of the system were notoriously inaccurate, but our manager assured us that it was okay, because he only used the numbers that supported his personal opinion anyway. It was during this year that I realized the world would run smoothly if companies employed far fewer people like me. In the years that followed, managers all over the world reached the same realization. It was the dawn of downsizing. The first rounds of downsizing erased people like Dean and me, people in jobs that sound good in concept, but provide no legitimate value to anybody. The company improved its earnings, and nobody worked harder because of it. Dean and I actually survived by anticipating where the downsizings would happen and slithering into more protected areas. The second rounds of downsizing were tougher. The employees who remained had to work harder to pick up the duties of the departing workers, but in many cases, they were exempt employees, meaning they will work extra hours without squawking too much about extra pay. Result, the companies improved their earnings. They knew they had a winning strategy here. For the third round of downsizings, essential jobs were eliminated in huge numbers, but mostly in areas where the impact wouldn't be noticed for at least a year. That includes areas like research, new systems development, business expansion, and training. Result, the companies improved their earnings. There didn't seem to be any bottom to this downsizing well. The bold companies who are contemplating the fourth round of downsizing are relying on the promises of re-engineering to free up some human charcoal to fuel the downsizing barbecue. The secret to making downsizing work is for managers to recognize the psychological impact. Experiments on laboratory animals show that if you apply continuous electrical shocks to a captive dog, eventually your utility bill will be so high that you'll feel angry at the dog. Companies apply the same medical theory to downsizing. The first rounds of downsizing usually get the people that nobody likes anyway. Those are easy. By the later rounds, managers begin to genuinely hate the remaining employees. They'll become cold-hearted enough to fire family members while humming show tunes. That's when the real savings start. During the banking phase of my career, I had the opportunity to work in a variety of jobs for which I was thoroughly unqualified. Fortunately, none of these jobs added value to the company, so my incompetence didn't do much to damage the local economy. At one point, I was working as a commercial loan approver for professional loans, business loans to doctors, even though I had never made a loan or taken a class in lending. Veteran lending officers were instructed to submit their loan proposals to our department for approval. Each loan package was reviewed by all five members of this group, in case anybody missed anything, and then we took it to our boss for the real approval. Although I had no formal training, I learned much on the job. Well, actually, three things. Doctors are bad customers because they can prescribe drugs for themselves. According to my ex-boss, all Chinese customers cheat on their taxes, thus providing excellent cash flow for repaying loans. Later, I learned this was an unfair generalization. Lastly, if your coworker brings his coffee mug to the men's room every day to wash it, you can tell people he goes in there to sit in a stall and drink coffee. When the downsizing began, it didn't hurt much. Instead of five non-value-added people, we had four, three, then eventually only me. I let everybody know that I was doing the work of five people. I got no sympathy because everybody was doing the work of five people, if you believed what you heard. Eventually, I left the job. For the past 13 years, zero people have been doing the work of five people, but there have been no complaints. Downsizing had a future. Pessimists point out that the first people to flee a shrinking company are the bright people who can take the buyout package and immediately get better jobs elsewhere. The dullard employees who remain produce low-quality work, but they compensate by working long hours and producing more low-quality work per person than ever before. The pessimists would have us believe that this is a bad thing. I was one of the people who survived all the early rounds of downsizing, so I know that the pessimists are wrong. Contrary to their gloomy little logic, I was not producing large volumes of low-quality work after the downsizing. In fact, I moved to a strategy job where I produced no work at all. After all the bright people fled, companies realized they had to make downsizing sound like more of a positive development in order to keep morale high. For some reason, morale was low for the employees who realized that their workload had tripled, their salaries remained unchanged, and they were still there after all the good people had left. This was accomplished through a creative process of inventing happier-sounding phrases that all meant essentially the same thing. 1980, you're fired. 1985, you're laid off. 1990, you're downsized. 1992, you're right-sized. I expect this trend to continue. You'll see the following phrases used within the next 5 years. You're happy-sized. You're splendid-sized. You're orgasm-sized. Now what about quality? I worked for Pacific Bell for several years before I heard the term quality with a capital Q. Suddenly, almost overnight, the phrase total quality management started popping up in every meeting. I was embarrassed that I didn't know what it was. I compensated by nodding my head vigorously whenever the topic came up. Occasionally, I would corner people and ask them to explain total quality management to me. They always mumbled something like, improvement, process, then zipped away like fleas in a wind tunnel. Sometimes they would give me this sage advice before departing. You should take a quality training class. I felt like an outsider. I couldn't understand why nobody would tell me what this quality thing was all about, especially since it was obviously a very good thing. After all, if it wasn't a good thing, it would have a different name, such as totally bad management. This quality thing was something important, and I wanted in. One day my prayers were answered. Our team leader informed us that we were going to apply quality methods to our project. Finally, I would get to glimpse the secret treasures that were quality. I awaited the next meeting with much excitement and anticipation. Our team leader started the meeting by drawing a diagram of a fish skeleton on the whiteboard. This was the famous fishbone diagram, an important quality tool, he explained. He informed us that our task was to identify root causes for our slow product development process. Once we understood the root causes, it would be easier to craft the appropriate solution. The only wrinkle is that we had already decided on the solution days earlier, and we agreed it wasn't going to change because of a dead fish. So we agreed to start with a known solution and reverse engineer to find out the root cause. This was a huge time saver. After filling out a few extraneous spines of the fish with what we decided were not root causes, a general sense of boredom set in. We decided that the team leader could probably fill out the rest of the fish on his own while we talked about other things. The process worked smoothly. After the meeting, I understood why nobody had explained total quality management to me. Unfortunately, I became an accomplice to this dirty little secret. When people asked me to explain quality, I would mumble, root cause, take a training class, and then excuse myself. I felt bad about the whole thing until I discovered that you can win awards for quality. Companies in the United States compete for the Malcolm Baldrige Award. The winner is the company that can do the best job of convincing a panel of judges that they actually use quality methods. Fortunately, it's easy to define whatever you're already doing as a quality process. In fact, you'd look like an orangutan if you said you did things any other way. Compare these quality processes to non-quality processes. Quality process? Ask customers what they want. Or non-quality process? Ram your lousy product down the throats of the idiot customers who couldn't possibly know what they want. Quality process? Measure performance in key areas. Or, a non-quality process, weigh yourself and take your temperature daily. Quality process? Determine the root cause of problems. Or, non-quality process, solve all problems in alphabetical order. Quality process? Involve employees in decisions that affect their jobs. Or, non-quality process, ask, if employees are so smart, why are they so poor? Quality process? Test new processes before widely adopting them. Or, non-quality process? Don't be a wuss. If it doesn't work, blame the employees. It seems to me there's one flaw in the total quality management concept. If you're not already doing the common sense things defined as quality, what are the chances that quality training will help? Let's say I send you to quality training and you learn that you should look for the root cause of problems before trying to solve them. And let's say you thought that was an amazing revelation. In this hypothetical example, would you be the type of person who could accurately identify the root cause of a problem? Or is it fair to say you're the type of person who would take a number 2 pencil to a home pregnancy test? In order for total quality management to make sense, you have to assume that humans are capable of looking at facts, finding root causes, and then formulating solutions. On my planet, there's not much evidence to support this assumption. If humans had the ability to look at facts and make good decisions, think how different the world would be. There would only be about 6 types of cars on the market, and nobody would buy a car that's second best in the same price range. There would be no such thing as jury selection, since all jurors would reach the same conclusion after viewing the facts. There would only be one religion. People would look at all the facts and pick the logical one. Elections would be decided unanimously. That's not the world we live in. Our brains are wired backwards. We make the decision first, based on irrational forces and personal motives. Then we do the analysis. The facts get whittled until they fit into the right holes. By the time you spray on a few layers of company politics, any quality solution looks just like any non-quality solution, except for the fish autopsies. You could argue that some people are smarter than others, so all you have to do is identify the smart ones and put them on quality teams. But that won't work because the smart people are the first to figure out how to avoid quality teams. And that's probably a good thing. Nothing is less productive than a group of so-called smart people. Smart people disagree, just like everybody else, except they're less likely to compromise. You get the same irrational output, but it takes longer. Quality is the business world's equivalent of disco. It makes you do goofy stuff, but it's hard to resist because so many other people are doing it. In many companies, you can't be a team player unless you embrace quality methods. In the early days of the movement, that was easier because nobody knew what those quality methods were. Anybody who could use quality words in a conversation was a recognized member of the quality inner circle. What this place needs is some metrics. For most managers, the quality movement meant putting the word quality on their letterhead, coffee mugs, and memos. That's how they signaled to their superiors that they were serious about quality, while at the same time signaling to their subordinates, not really, get to work. Managers understand that the right balance with respect to quality is to appear supportive, but not so much that their names will be associated with quality when it self-destructs. You don't want to wake up one day and find yourself the director of quality when the whole silly thing collapses under its own weight. I predict that quality will eventually be replaced by a management technique that has all the benefits of quality, insofar as it won't change what you're doing, but the new method will be better because it won't have a bad track record. That's when you'll see some real improvements. And what about re-engineering? Re-engineering was invented by Dr. Jonas Salk as a cure for quality programs. Just kidding. The acknowledged parents of re-engineering are Michael Hammer and James Champy. When I say they're the parents, I don't mean they had sex, and I apologize for making you think about it. I mean they wrote the best-selling business book, Re-Engineering the Corporation, published in 1993. Business leaders flocked to re-engineering like frat boys to a drunken cheerleader. This analogy wasn't necessary, but I'm trying to get my mind off that Hammer and Champy thing. Re-engineering involves finding radical new approaches to your current business processes. On paper, this compares favorably with the quality approach, which involves becoming more efficient at the things you shouldn't be doing. But there is a dark side to re-engineering. There's a risk that whatever natural incompetence is present in the company can be unleashed in epic scale instead of doled out in puny quality portions. This can be dangerous if, as I've often stated, we're all a bunch of idiots. Hammer noted this risk and cleverly followed up with another book in 1995, The Re-Engineering Revolution. It described all the boneheaded things that managers did to screw up his recipe for re-engineering. Re-engineering has a tendency to reduce the number of employees needed to perform a function. That unfortunate side effect causes fear and mistrust in the employees whose participation is vital to making re-engineering a success. You might think fear and mistrust would sabotage the effort, but that doesn't have to be the case. There are many examples of processes that work just fine, even when there's plenty of fear and mistrust. Examples: capital punishment, presidential elections, and multi-level marketing. Pity the poor slob who is assigned the task of re-engineering the company. Insufficient management support from above, treachery from below. It's possible to succeed, but the odds are against it. Here are some specific obstacles to re-engineering. Managers are often asked to donate employees from their groups to the company's re-engineering effort. This is an opportunity for managers to unload their most incompetent employees, all in the name of teamwork. These incompetent employees act as silver bullets to destroy the re-engineering project while leaving the existing organization intact. Once the silver bullets are assembled, it's time to have some meetings and brainstorm about radical re-engineering options. Silver bullet number one. Does anybody have any radical re-engineering ideas? Silver bullet number two. Why don't we pre-lick all of our envelopes? Silver bullet number three. That's more like an incremental quality idea than a radical re-engineering idea. Silver bullet number two. We could downsize some people we don't know, thus saving money. Silver bullet number three. Who would do their work? Silver bullet number two. Other people we don't know? Silver bullet number one. I like those numbers. Mid-level managers who are threatened by re-engineering will make clever defensive adjustments. They quickly redefine whatever they're already doing as re-engineering. Suddenly, your customer service project gets renamed the Customer Service Re-engineering Project. You're not getting a haircut. You're re-engineering your head. You're not going to lunch. You're re-engineering your intestines. Pretty soon, there's so much re-engineering going on that it's hard to find anything that isn't re-engineering, at least in name. Then comes budget time. Senior executives know they should be funding something called re-engineering, or else they'll look like troglodytes. Re-engineering is in, and it's happening. The cheapest way to fund it is to call stuff you're already funding re-engineering. Senior managers were once middle managers. They know how to manage a budget. The executive might throw a bone to the one real re-engineering project by giving them some money to do a small trial. Typically, none of the technology or resources that are proposed for the large-scale test are available for the trial, so planning goes like this. Team member number one. We'll need distributed workstations, all connected by a worldwide satellite network system. Team member number two. All we have is this pot of decaf coffee that was left over from the meeting before ours. Team member number three. Let's use it. We can interpolate the results. Team member number one. Are you nuts? That's decaf! Re-engineering a company is a bit like performing an appendectomy on yourself. It hurts quite a bit. You might not know exactly how to do it, and there's a good chance you won't survive it. But if it does work, you'll gain enough confidence to go after some of the more vital organs, such as that big red pumping thing. How to tell if your company is doomed. Check for the presence of any of these deadly factors: cubicles, teamwork, presentations to management, reorganizations, or processes. Assuming your computer hasn't made you sterile, someday your descendants will look back and be amazed that people of our generation worked in things called cubicles. They will view our lives much the way we now view the workers from the Industrial Revolution, who, I've heard, work 23 hours a day making steel products using nothing but their foreheads. Imagine our descendants' disbelief when they read stories about how we were forced to sit in big boxes all day, enduring a stream of annoying noises, odors, and interruptions. They might think it was the product of some cruel experiment. The widespread use of cubicles is a direct result of early laboratory tests on rats. In the early 1960s, rats were placed in a scale model cubicle environment and given a set of unreasonable objectives. At first, the rats scurried around excitedly, looking for cheese. Eventually, they realized that their efforts were not rewarded. The rats fell into a pattern of attending meetings and complaining about a lack of training. The researchers labeled these rats poor team players and ignored them. Many of the rats died or escaped, thus reducing the headcount. Companies heard of this new method for reducing headcount and began moving employees into cubicles. If your company already has cubicles, it doesn't necessarily mean it's doomed. But if the direction of the company is towards smaller cubicles or more people in each cubicle, you're doomed. If you hear a lot of talk about teamwork at your company, you're doomed. The whole concept of teamwork changed when it migrated from the world of sports to the world of business. In basketball, a good team player is somebody who passes the ball. If you put a business person on a basketball team, he'd follow the player with a ball saying something like, "What do you plan to do with that?" Teamwork is the opposite of good time management. You can't do a good job of managing your time unless you can blow off your coworkers. They will try to convince you to abandon your priorities in favor of their priorities. They are selfish and evil. When you're a team player, you look like a big old pile of birdseed in an aviary. Every coworker will swoop in for a beak full of your resources and leave a little present, that has limited resale value. Anywhere you see teamwork, you'll see people with lots of beak wounds on their heads. All companies experience some degree of teamwork, but they're not all doomed. An easy way to determine if you have enough teamwork to be doomed is to simply measure how long it takes from the time you decide to go to lunch together until the time you actually eat. If it takes 5 minutes, teamwork is annoying, but not actually dangerous. If it takes 15 minutes, danger, red alert. If it takes an hour, teamwork has reached critical mass. Your company is doomed. Your company is doomed if your primary product is overhead transparencies. A typical company has just enough resources to do one of the following: accomplish something, or prepare elaborate presentations that lie about how much is being accomplished. The rational employee will divert all available resources away from accomplishing things and toward the more highly compensated process of lying about accomplishments. It's the same amount of work, but only one has a payoff. Managers are like cats in a litter box. They instinctively shuffle things around to conceal what they've done. In the business world, this process is called reorganizing. A normal manager will reorganize often, as long as he's fed. You can tell that you've reorganized too often, and are therefore doomed, if you hear your coworkers asking any one of these questions in the hallways. If I had to live in a dumpster, how bad would that be? Where do street people shower? Is tuberculosis fatal? If your company is staffed with a bunch of boneheads, you are doomed. This situation is usually referred to indirectly as a need for process improvement. If you notice a lot of attention being given to process improvement, it's a sure sign that all of the smart employees have left the company, and those who remain are desperately trying to find a process that is so simple that the boneheads who remain can handle it. At this point, it would be very funny to close your eyes and imagine a public address system at your office with the following announcement: Marilyn Vos Savant has left the building. In case you didn't know, Marilyn Vos Savant has the highest IQ of any human. She once scared a Rubik's Cube into alignment just by staring at it. And now for a change of direction. What follows are a variety of untested suggestions from an author who has never successfully managed anything but his cats. And now that I think of it, I haven't seen the gray one for 2 days. Some people think that because I cleverly mock current management methods, that I must have some excellent ideas which I am selfishly keeping to myself. Over time, I have begun to believe this myself. If this doesn't prove my central thesis, that we're all idiots, then nothing will. I doubt that anything you hear here will improve your life, but I'm fairly confident that it won't hurt you either, and that's better than a lot of the things you're doing now. If any of you are gullible enough to take my recommendations, don't say you weren't warned. That said, I think you'll find some interesting ideas here. The key to good management is knowing what's fundamental to success and what's not. Here's my grand insight about company fundamentals. Companies with effective employees and good products usually do well. Ta-da! That might seem like a blinding flash of the obvious, but look around your company and see how many activities are at least one level removed from something that improves either the effectiveness of the people or the quality of the product. By the way, if you're in one of those jobs, you might want to update your resume. Any activity that is one level removed from your people or your product will ultimately fail or have little benefit. It won't seem like that when you're doing it, but it's a consistent pattern. It's hard to define what I mean by being one level removed, but you know it when you see it. Examples help. If you're writing code for a new software release, that's fundamental, because you're improving the product. But if you're creating a policy about writing software, then you're one level removed. If you're testing a better way to assemble a product, that's fundamental. But if you're working on a task force to develop a suggestion system, then you're one level removed. If you're talking to a customer, that's fundamental. If you're talking about customers, you're probably one level removed. If you're involved in anything on the list I'm about to read, you're one level removed from the fundamentals of your company, and you will not be missed if you are abducted by aliens. Quality fair, process improvement team, recognition committee, employee satisfaction survey, suggestion system, ISO 9000, standards, policy improvement, reorganization, budget process, writing vision statements, writing mission statements, writing an approved equipment list. These one-off activities are irresistible. You can make a convincing argument for all of them. You couldn't run a company, for example, without a budget process. I'm not suggesting that you try. But I think you can focus more of your energy on the fundamentals, people and product, by following a simple rule for the one-off activities. Resist the urge to tinker. It's always tempting to improve the organizational structure, or to rewrite the company policy to address a new situation, or to create committees to improve employee morale. Individually, all of those things seem to make sense. But experience shows that you generally end up with something that is no more effective than what you started with. For example, companies tinker endlessly with the formula for employee compensation. Rarely does this result in happier and more productive employees. The employees redirect their energies toward griping and preparing resumes. The managers redirect their energies toward explaining and justifying the new system. The rule of consistency would direct you toward keeping your current compensation plan, warts and all, unless it's a true abomination. The company that focuses on fundamentals will generate enough income to make any compensation plan seem adequate. The best example of a fruitless one-off activity that seems like a good idea is the reorganization. Have you ever seen an internal company reorganization that dramatically improved either the effectiveness of the employees or the quality of the product? Sometimes there are indirect benefits, because a reorganization is a good excuse for weeding out the ninnies. But that hardly justifies the disruption. The rule of consistency would say it's best to keep the organization as it is, unless there's a fundamental shift in the business. Add or subtract people as needed, but leave the framework alone. Let the employees spend time on something besides reordering business cards. Many of the one-off activities start taking care of themselves if you're doing a good job with your people and products. A company with a good product rarely needs a mission statement. Effective employees will suggest improvements without being on a quality team. Nobody will miss the employee recognition committee if the managers are effective and routinely recognize good performance. The budget process will suddenly look very simple if you're making money by focusing on your products. As far as consistency goes, I would make an exception for changes that are radical enough to qualify as re-engineering. It's the fiddling I object to, not elimination or major streamlining. If you buy my argument that too much energy is being spent on one-off activities, the next question is how to focus on the fundamentals of making your people more effective and your products more desirable. I'm here to help. I developed a conceptual model for a perfect company. The primary objective of this company is to make the employees as effective as possible. I figure the best products usually come from the most effective employees, so employee effectiveness is the most fundamental of the fundamentals. The goal of my hypothetical company is to get the best work out of the employees and make sure they leave work by 5 o'clock. Finishing by 5 o'clock is so central to everything that follows that I named the company OA5, short for Out at 5, to reinforce the point. If you let this part of the concept slip, the rest of it falls apart. You'll see why. In today's corporate environment, the employee who walks out the door at 5 p.m. is held in lower regard than a Michael Jackson daycare center. The goal of OA5 is to change that, to guarantee that the employee who leaves at 5 has done a full share of work and everybody realizes it. For that to happen, the OA5 company has to do things differently than an ordinary company. Companies use a lot of energy trying to increase employee satisfaction. That's very nice of them, but let's face it, work sucks. If people liked work, they'd do it for free. The reason we have to pay people to work is because work is inherently unpleasant compared to the alternatives. At OA5, we recognize that the best way to make employees satisfied about their work is to help them get away from it as much as possible. An OA5 company isn't willing to settle for less productivity from the employees, just less time. The underlying assumptions for OA5 are: happy employees are more productive and creative. There's a limit to how much happiness you can get while you're at work. Big gains in happiness can only be made by spending more time away from work. The average person is only mentally productive a few hours a day, no matter how many hours are worked. People know how to compress their activities to fit a reduced time. Doing so increases both their energy and their interest. The payoff is direct and personal. They go home early. A company can't do much to stimulate happiness and creativity, but it can do a lot to kill them. The trick for the company is to stay out of the way. When companies try to encourage creativity, it's like a bear dancing with an ant. Sooner or later, the ant will realize it's a bad idea, although the bear might not. Most people are creative by nature and happy by default. It doesn't seem that way because modern management is designed to squash those impulses. An OA5 company is designed to stay out of the way and let the good things happen. Here's how. Let the employees dress any way they want, decorate their workspaces any way they want, format their memos any way they want. Nobody has ever demonstrated that these areas have an impact on productivity. When you manage those things, you send a clear signal that conformity is valued above either efficiency or creativity. It's better to get out of the way and reinforce the message that you expect people to focus on what is important. I stop short of recommending that all employees should use any kind of computer they want. Every situation is different. But there can be overriding efficiency considerations for keeping a standard computer type. Efficiency has to be a higher principle than creativity, otherwise you have chaos. What does an OA5 manager do? Staying out of the way isn't much of a job description for a manager. So if you want to be a manager in an OA5 company, you'll need to do some actual work, too. Here are the most useful activities I can think of for a manager. Eliminate the assholes. Nothing can drain the life force out of your employees as much as a few sadistic assholes who seem to exist for the sole purpose of making life hard for others. Sadly, assholes often have important job skills that you'd like to keep. My advice is that it's never worth the trade-off. In an OA5 company, it's okay to be tough and aggressive, and it's okay to disagree, even shout. Some conflict is healthy, but if you do it with disrespect, or you seem to be enjoying it, or you do it in every situation, guess what? You're an asshole. And you're gone. Make sure your employees are learning something every day. Ideally, they should learn things that directly help on the job, but learning anything at all should be encouraged. Here are some ways you can ensure that people are learning daily. Support requests for training, even when not directly job-related. Share your knowledge freely and ask others to do the same, ideally in small, digestible chunks. Make trade magazines and newspapers available. If the budget allows, try to keep employees in current computers and software. Make internet connections available. Support experimentation even when you know it's doomed if the cost is low. Make teaching a part of everybody's job description. Reward employees who do a good job of communicating useful information to coworkers. Collectively, all the little things create an environment that supports curiosity and learning. Imagine a job where, after you've screwed up, your boss says, "What did you learn?" instead of, "What the hell were you thinking?" Teach employees how to be efficient. Lead by example, but also continuously reinforce the following behaviors in others. Do creative work in the morning, and do routine, brainless work in the afternoon. For example, staff meetings should be held in the afternoon, if at all. This can have a huge impact on people's actual and perceived effectiveness. Keep meetings short. Get to the point and get on. Make it clear that brevity and clarity are prized. The reward for brevity is the ability to leave at 5 o'clock with a clear conscience. Every company says that brevity is good, but only an OA5 company rewards it directly. Blow off low-priority activities and make it clear why. Don't be sucked into an activity because it's the polite thing to do. If it's a one-off activity, say no. Say why you're saying no. Be direct. Respectfully interrupt people who talk too long without getting to the point. At first it will seem rude. Eventually, it gives everybody permission to do the same. And that's a trade-off that can be appreciated. Remember, there's a reward. You get down at 5. Be efficient in the little things. For example, rather than have some Byzantine process for doling out office supplies, add $25 a month to each employee's paycheck as a supply stipend, and let them buy whatever they need from their local store. If they spend less, they keep the difference. If you create an internal memo with a typo, just line it out and send it. Never reprint it. Better yet, stick with email. A culture of efficiency starts with the everyday things that you can directly control: clothes, meeting lengths, conversation with coworkers, and the like. The way you approach these everyday activities establishes the culture that will drive your fundamental activities. What message does a company send when it huddles its managers together for several days to produce a mission statement that sounds something like this? "We design integrated world-class solutions on a worldwide basis." Answer: it sends a message that the managers can't write, can't think, and can't identify priorities. Managers are obsessed with the big picture. They look for the big picture in vision statements and mission statements and quality programs. I think the big picture is hiding in the details. It's in the clothes, the office supplies, the casual comments, and the coffee. I'm all for working on the big picture, if you know where to find it. Finally, and this is the last time I'm going to say it, We're all idiots, and we're going to make mistakes. That's not necessarily bad. I have a saying, creativity is allowing yourself to make mistakes. Art is knowing which ones to keep. Keep your people fresh, happy, and efficient. Set a target and then get out of the way. Let art happen. Sometimes idiots can accomplish wonderful things.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.